You're listening to The Stone Tapes with Sam Stone, David J. Howe, Patricia H. Ash, George Mann and Robin Pierce. A show which sheds a little slice of geek sunshine into the ether.
In dreams he came.
In fact, that maybe with your love. Oh,
Well, that's a little bit of a sore spot, I think, at the moment, infected by there. And welcome to the 59th edition of the Stone Tapes. Joining us in the studio today, we have David J. Howe.
Yeah, I think I should have a bell and go, unclean.
He has got a cough. But it's not Corona.
But it's not Corona.
Eloise Sheehan.
Hello.
We also have with us for the first time, Eleanor Dean.
Hi.
Welcome, hello. Eleanor. And welcome back, George Mann.
Hello.
He's here.
Hi, George.
I'm pleased to be back.
We're very pleased to have you. And also with our producer extraordinaire, Alex Lefchuk.
Hello.
He's here.
You can just about hear him. We've kept the microphone away on purpose,
That's right.
You know how that goes.
He's just in a little room nearby.
He is. Yes.
But first of all, well, later on we'll be joined by Robin Pearce as well, all the way from Deepest Wales. But first of all, we're going to now speak to Patricia H. Ash. Hello, Patricia. Are you with us?
Hello.
She's there.
Hello, my dear.
Hello. Awesome cakes. Fantastic.
What are you going to be reviewing today?
Well, I thought I would do the podcast Flintlocks and Fireballs.
Love the name.
Is the Dungeons and Oh my gosh. It's a Dungeons and Dragons podcast with probably the best world building I have ever heard on a podcast. Mm-hmm. It is so detailed. I really want like a world book so I can run a campaign in this setting because it's so cool. It's kind of based on the Napoleonic Wars era, thus the Flintlocks, and there's obviously magic because Dungeons and Dragons, so fireballs, which one of the characters can cast now.
So explain to us what actually takes place on this podcast.
Well, adventuring. It's been going for a while, and the episodes are very long. That's the only downside of this podcast. The episodes are a good 4 hours long.
You're
signing up for some intense gameplay.
So they're actually playing Dungeons & Dragons on the podcast?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
They need, like, intervals for Libra.
I think so. You need something.
They take a break because they do have ads, but it's small, and it's a podcast.
So I suppose you can always pause
stop it and start it whenever you need to. But it's long, and you don't want to miss a second of the episode because things are happening from the first minute to the last second.
Wow.
And it's really a question of what doesn't happen in this podcast. I'm almost caught up, but not quite. The most recent arc I've listened to, let's see, they went to the Underdark and may have destroyed an entire city. And before that, they mitigated the, absolutely not the French Revolution. Definitely, yes, that's exactly what it's based on. Like, that part is based so closely on historical events that you could be like, oh, that character's that guy. He's going to get assassinated. Oh, they stopped it. Yay!
So for people who don't know what Dungeons & Dragons is or have never played it, like me, for example.
Just for example.
What actually, you know, how do they go about playing this game on a podcast? I just can't imagine it. Are they dishing up cards and then responding to them? What actually happens?
Well, most of it is character and story. And at certain points, they will roll dice and the result of the dice will inform what they do next. It's kind of like an improv game with dice.
Oh, right. So it's role play as well.
Suggesting it another way, it's like listening to episodes of like a very long fantasy novel, but in kind of real time.
Yes.
Oh, sounds cool.
So
yeah,
you have presumably one of these guys is the dungeon master. So he's controlling it, explaining what they are, where they are, what they're doing, so on and so on, what threats are coming up towards them, blah, blah, blah. And then presumably you've got a number of other characters. I don't know, a wizard, a troll, a dwarf, an elf, whatever, human, however they've pitched it. And these characters are basically interacting and understanding in this world that they are creating and developing.
And there's generally like a storyline that the Games Masters look, helping them to follow, but it can go in different directions.
Yes.
And kind of comes back to the main story.
Is it fundamentally sort of quest based in that respect?
The main Dungeons and Dragons game
is they have something to do, you have to go somewhere, get something, do something. Yeah. In order to do it. So is
exactly.
this is what this is following as well, yeah?
Yeah. So everyone has their own personal quest that they want to do, like a long term thing, like they've just bought a ship so that the halfling can become a pirate king and kill the Kraken.
Oh, okay.
Poor Kraken. They started at level one. You can't kill a Kraken at level one.
So do they have?
But eventually, that's what they're going to do.
Wow.
So does each character then that's taking part in the podcast have a particular episode dedicated more to them and their quest?
This group works really well together as an ensemble, but they've also got like things that are a little bit more about them. There was a creepy ancient pyramid in a jungle, and that was a lot about the tiefling sorcerer, that chunk of the story, and the Underdark bit, that was about the drow bard whose family wants to sort of hammer her into this round hole, and she's a very, very flamboyant square peg.
So it goes where it needs to go, basically, I think is sort
of
the answer.
Yeah, it really does.
It's whatever and the Dungeon Master is controlling it, and to some extent.
Do they have different people every week, sort of guests and stuff, or is it just the same guys?
It's mostly the same guys, but they do have special episodes where they'll have a guest.
You see, I was wondering if they had like phone in or something, and you could phone in for an episode and play one of the characters along with them or something.
No, I wish. I mean, they do most of their recording sessions over Skype.
Well, it's possible, isn't it?
Like Skype, because it's definitely possible because they're all four working actors.
That explains it.
That explains it.
Because there's a TV show like this.
In the early days of the podcast, one of them went on tour with a play doing puppets.
Wow.
They're all working actors, so they're all in different places generally.
And I had a quick look at the website, which for anyone who wants to know is basically HTTPS flintlocksandfireballs.com flintlocksandfireballs.com. And like you said, Patricia, it's up to kind of like episode 80 something now,
and they're all 4 hours long.
It is.
There's a vast number of these things. So if you have busy, you've got nothing to do for the next couple.
When you're self isolating,
when you're self isolating, you could happily spend a couple of months there.
Well, I was going to suggest downloading books if you're self-isolating.
COVID is in my city.
Wow. It sounds fascinating. Absolutely.
It does.
I've never heard
it's become a real thing. So there's this... have you seen Daredevil, the TV show?
Yes.
So the woman who plays Karen Page in that runs a TV show where she has a group of actors, and she's the Dungeon Master, and they play Dungeons and Dragons, and she does have a guest actor. So like someone like Elijah Ward is there for the episode, and he plays a character with them. And that's been popular and going for a little while now as well.
And I suppose it does rely a great deal on having very good improvisation skills.
And good imagination.
And a good imagination for sure.
And going with it, I think.
You heard it here. If you like Dungeons & Dragons style podcasts, then Flintlocks and Fireballs might be for you. Thank you so much, Patricia.
Oh, yeah. 10 out of 10. Definitely recommend.
Thank you.
don't even know what that actually is without being told.
David, I have no idea. What is that? It was nice. What is it, though?
It's from Resident Evil.
Is it?
I know.
It doesn't sound very scary.
No.
It's quite nice, actually.
It sounds western. It sounds like something that could be played at... cowboys riding through a desert.
Zombies Out West.
Yeah.
It's been too long since there's been a western zombie movie.
Oh, yeah.
I think there needs to be more.
Has there ever been one?
I don't know.
We should get on this.
What we really need, if we all focus really, really hard, maybe we can get somebody on the show now who knows a lot about films and who could tell us if there's ever been a western zombie movie. What do you think? So everyone focus. Is there anyone there?
Hello there.
Hello, oh, Robert Pierce.
As you say, I'm piercing the veil. Hey, kid.
Hello. It's Robin Pierce.
Hello, Robin.
Hello there. Hi. It feels like a long time since we've done one of these.
It is. I think it's a little longer than normal because we did an early one last month.
Yeah.
I've missed you guys.
Bless you.
So we've got a packed room this evening, Robin. We have myself, of course, and Sam, and the lovely Alex.
Hiya, David. Hiya, Sam.
We've got George's here.
Hello.
Eloise is here.
Welcome.
Hello.
And we've also got a lovely lady called Eleanor.
Hi.
Yep. And somebody forgot to lock the door, so Eloise is in again.
I know. We tried, but you know how it goes. I mean, I even tried laying a trail of sweets like out of the building, but it didn't work.
So, Robin, has there ever been a transfer like a raptor?
So, has there ever been a zombie western?
No.
We've just invented a new genre.
I'm opening in the market there, then.
I think it was your idea. You said it, George. I think you need to write it.
Right, by next month.
There was a zombie cowboy in The House 2.
Yes, there was.
Right.
Second story. But I don't believe there's ever been a zombie western, and I believe that there would be a market for it because I'd go to a cinema chain to watch that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had zombie rednecks, of course, and Cabin in the Woods, but that's about as close as.
Incidentally, speaking of rednecks, thank you so much for that recommendation about Tucker and Dale.
Oh, Tucker and Dale! Oh yes, what a great film! What did you think?
I loved it.
Have you seen Tucker?
Steve and I were practically howling from the beginning right until the end.
Yeah.
It really does. It makes you laugh so hard, that film. It's so clever. It's so well observed and so well done.
It is a great, but also I love it
when the kids all start killing themselves around them. And it's just...
Tucker and Dale. Tucker and Dale versus the world,
evil.
Isn't it? Versus evil. That's it. I'm getting mixed up.
Versus evil, yes.
It's a great film.
Great film.
Speaking of great films,
yes,
I've seen one.
Do tell.
Wow.
Just one, Robin.
Well, you know, I've been on the show long enough that you guys know how I feel about remakes.
Yes.
Okay.
I think we're all in the same camp on that one.
Yeah. Remakes, reboots, and reimaginings. Oh, my goodness. And you guys know how I feel about the horror movie output of Universal Pictures from 1930 to around 1948 when they finished with Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yes.
Right? Major fan. Now, a little bit of historical perspective here. Universal keep trying to reboot the success that they had back then in light of the success that Marvel have had with their interconnected universe. And they think, well, we did this first with Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman and all this. We can do it again. Mm. And we've had, well, they've had two stabs at remaking The Mummy. The first with Brendan Fraser,
yes.
which turned out to be nothing more than Indiana Jones with mummies.
It was good, though. Yeah, but good fun. I'm up for that.
Yeah. Where was the horror, though? These are horror films to begin with.
The horror was when they released the third film in that series.
Yeah, that was a horror. Oh,
the one that didn't even have a mummy in.
Yes.
And of course we had The Mummy with Tom Cruise, which was basically Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
With a mummy.
Yeah.
That's true.
Tom Cruise.
I don't argue with Aaron.
And that actually was supposed to start Universal's Dark Universe, which was going to be this interconnected universe, because if you remember, we saw a long tracking shot of a lab, and they even had the hand, the claw of the creature from the Black Lagoon in there.
Good lord.
Oh, wow.
Yeah?
And that little bit with Jekyll and Hyde in the middle.
Oh, God, he was rubbish.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
That middle part in.
Oh. Now then, that film tanked. So, you know, Universal were scratching their heads and thinking, what can we do? We've got these properties. What can we do? So they decided a relaunch again, but this time with Blumhouse Productions, who are known for making some pretty decent horror movies.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And rather than go for our Egyptian friend, they took the wraps off. You see what I did there?
Yes.
See what I did there?
We did.
And unveiled. See what I'm still doing here? this doesn't just get thrown together, you know. The Invisible Man. Based, loosely on the 1933 film with Claude Rains, directed by James Whale, which was a marvel of its time.
It certainly was.
Jack Griffin has taken this serum. He gets invisible. He walks through the Welsh countryside of Universal's back lot in the Hollywood Hills.
Lovely.
And, there's lovely,
there's
man.
Lovely.
There's lovely.
And,
yes, it's brilliant. So gradually, having made a film with no mummy in, you're now not going to make a film with actually no one in at all. That's genius, to be honest.
Well, young David.
Yes.
Hold on to your seat. So he gradually goes insane.
Yes.
And what worked then, set in the present day of 1933, will not work in 2020. So, they did a reboot, and it's one of which I heartily approve. Because what you've got is not a guy taking a serum. I mean, we've already seen that in, you know, Invisible Man, Hollow mm-hmm. Man, any invisibility-themed thing that you care to think of. But he's got a suit, a tight-fitting leather suit, with a hood. It looks a little bit like one of those. I can stray away from that one.
Okay. Sorry, Robbie.
And popularized in Pulp Fiction. And he's got all these cameras on it, which kind of, you know, sort of give him an invisibility effect.
Ah, so it's not
something that he's ingested or bombarded himself with. It is a suit that he wears.
Right, okay. Interesting. So it's not going to affect his life ultimately as long as he's not wearing the suit.
But he's already a bit crazy because he is basically a domestic abuser.
Oh.
And the film opens with his girlfriend leaving him, and he fakes his own death, and he uses a suit to exact his revenge.
Mm.
Now then. If I was going to pick this
kind of
film as a script, I would say, imagine sleeping with the enemy, except the guy is invisible.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And it works so incredibly well.
Okay.
Wasn't Hollow Man like that, if I remember right?
Yes, it was, but he wasn't that much of a domestic abuser, and they were trying to keep him in a lab. They tried to keep track of him, but he kept sneaking out.
Yeah, but
he
was a bit perverse. But
I'm a bit puzzled, Robin, because you see, in my mind, the whole point of the Invisible Man is that the man is invisible. There's a clue in the title. Not that he wears a suit that makes him invisible, that he is actually invisible.
Well, he's still a man. He's wearing a, I mean, I'm still male and I'm wearing jeans and a t-shirt.
You can say the same for Iron Man and everything else.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Oh,
that's good.
Oh. Yeah. No, yeah, but no.
No, David, you're not going
to
win.
The point I'm making it here is that with Iron Man, it was established from the get-go that it's a guy in an iron suit. That is the point of Iron Man. Yeah. The Invisible Man, from the get-go, has been a man who is invisible.
And that's been the case through every single film that
we've seen, through the TV series, through the Gemini Man, through Hollow Man, through every single variation of the Invisible Man.
Yes.
At the core is a man who is invisible.
That's right.
Except this one.
Except this one. And I think it works very, very well.
Oh, we'll have to give it a go. So what would you give
you
it
will.
Out of
10? I will
10?
Give it a solid 8 because I found myself scanning the cinema screen at all times, looking for any indication that he's there. And the first time you get an indication that he's there, they're standing outside and you just see the steam of somebody's breath coming out behind this person.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, no. Very, very clever, very, very well made. And the director has also written some of the Saw movies.
Oh, interesting.
And has already signed up to do another Universal monster movie. He is after Dracula.
But he won't be a vampire.
But he won't be a vampire.
He just likes drinking blood.
I have to say there again. If he is, though, I mean, it's another one of those. I just go, how many remakes of Dracula do we really need?
Did you see the BBC One adaptation?
Oh, yes, I did enjoy that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Very good.
Because he was a proper vampire. He wasn't
He was coming out of wolves.
You haven't seen it, Robin?
No, not seen that one yet.
It's worth a look.
Very, very gory.
It's worth a look. Anyway, stay with us, Robin. A little bit of Invisible Touch by Genesis.
We did that.
This is Chase Masterson, founder of the Pop Culture Hero Coalition, the first ever organization to make a stand against bullying, racism, misogyny, LGBT bullying, cyberbullying, and other forms of hate using pop culture stories that we love. We all love superheroes. Why not be one? check out our website at www.popculturehero.org. Follow us on Facebook at Pop Culture Hero Coalition and on Twitter at Superhero IRL. Thanks so much.
Lead writer for the world's longest-running magazine of sci-fi, horror and fantasy. Host of Piercing the Veil, regular Stone Tapes and Midweek Drive contributor, and the UK's very own Welsh Caped Crusader. Tis time for Robin Pierce.
Hang on. What's going on?
You're taking over the world, Robin.
I am. One radio show at a time.
We're not worthy.
Now for our discussion time. And we mentioned briefly the Saw films. I believe, Eloise, you're going to talk to us about those.
Yeah, obviously the Saw films have been quite popular, but I've never actually seen them myself, apart from last week when I decided to leave the universe and watch all 8 in a row.
8?
Wow. Yeah.
That's 8. Oh, my word.
That's commitment. It took me 2 days, which I think is quite good. But
is that 2 days you're never going to get back, or is that not the case?
I actually really enjoyed them.
Oh, wow.
I've been told a lot of things that they're too gruesome, or like they're not good enough, they get worse as they go along, but all 8 of them I thought were absolutely fantastic.
Oh, wow.
I quite like gory films, which helps, but I got a weird look from my boyfriend when I said I sort of agree with Jigsaw a bit, not in full extent.
So what's the premise for our listener who may not have seen
me?
George,
you may not have
seen.
No,
I've not seen them.
I've not seen them.
You haven't. Oh, okay.
Eleanor hasn't either.
I'm right. Not a horror fan.
Basically,
I'm going to sit here the entire time going,
give us a little. What's the premise?
Basically, two people wake up in a bathroom and they're chained to each side of the bathroom, and there's a tape, and they have to listen to the tape, and it tells them basically what they need to do. And these things, everything they have to do is so intricate and like pieces of a jigsaw. And these people are there for a reason. They've done something wrong. They've killed someone. They've been part of an insurance company that have been taking money from people.
Oh, I see.
People that are not, like, normally you would see as bad people. But they've been put in this room, and the only way they can get out is to give something back. There's loads of different traps and stuff they have to get through, and they can survive, but they have to give something, such as people that have been abusing people with their hands. They can get out of these traps, but they must crush their hands to get out.
Oh.
They're quite gruesome, but they're not that horrific as the fact they're not normal people that have been kidnapped and put in there. Mm.
So in a way, it's a bit like the Dexter modem, jigsaw, as you called him, is killing.
So Jigsaw's like the chap on the tape, isn't he?
He's the chap on the tape.
He deserves payback.
But there's so much in them.
He feels that he's been wronged, so he's, you know, he suffered cancer and he couldn't get some insurance, so he's after the person who missold him the insurance.
That's fair enough. We've all wanted to do that.
Eloise is absolutely right. There are these nasty traps. I mean, the one that keeps getting me is you can get out, but at a cost.
Mm.
And there's a particular trap where you have to reach your hand in to get the key to release yourself from being killed. They're all to do with power tools, mainly, aren't they, Eloise?
Oh. Yeah, they are.
An industrial type thing. And you've got to put your hand into this thing. And there's just out of reach is the key to unlock yourself so you can walk. But to get to that key, you need to basically reach in and split your fingers, you know, like the Spock salute. And you have to reach in, and what will cut your hand all the way open to the wrist is this circular saw.
Oh, my gosh.
They're all really quite
that kind of thing.
Jesus. But the way they are...
Why would you want to watch that?
If you look at it from the film point of view and the production, it's absolutely fantastic. It all looks so realistic, and it's just amazing the things that they have come up with, all these different traps and ideas, and they all link together. Nothing escapes you. It's amazing.
It's like taking Dr. Phoebes a hell of a lot further.
Also, the fact that they're actually bringing the new one out.
All the films fit together like the pieces of a jigsaw, that they're all interconnected. And if you watch them as you know, in close proximity, like Eloise did, you see how well written and how each one blends into the next one.
I don't want to be in a room with Eloise.
It's too late.
You're scaring me now.
But even the last film.
What are you going to have to do to get out of here?
What do we have to do to escape from this podcast?
Even the last film links to how the first one began, and everything makes sense by the time you've watched the eighth one.
Right.
Which is quite interesting because there's a new one being released in about 3 months. But oddly enough, it's Chris Rock, which is very strange, okay. I feel.
Interesting.
But presumably they didn't plan this. Presumably they did the one film and, oh, it was a success, we want another one.
I feel like there would have definitely had to have been planning.
Aha.
Was there not?
Well, I was lucky enough back in the day when I was doing interviews for the magazine I worked for before Starburst to talk to some of the writers and some of the cast. And it had all been meticulously planned. And basically, if somebody complained or, wanted more money, they'd be the next ones written out in the next film. The whole interlocking sort of overarching story was all meticulously planned with every T crossed and every I dotted. It was
interesting.
But how could they have known at the beginning they were going to make 8 films, 9 films, whatever?
I don't know.
Maybe they just hoped.
But even if you don't like, they get more gory as they go along.
Or Ari and George Lucas territory here, that he wrote 9 films, but then made the first one called Star Wars.
Yeah.
But each one gets worse and worse because obviously that's what the audience wanted to see a bit more. So I would suggest watching the first one because there really isn't much in that.
And it is mainly self-contained, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. It's fantastic, the first one.
Wow. I've never seen any of them.
But you will then be watching all of them.
I've always put the Saw films in kind of the buckets sort of labelled torture porn.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
It's just violence for violence's sake.
I was
sake.
Reading a bit about the director. He didn't actually mean to do that. It just ended up happening towards the end. Yeah. But the first one doesn't have really anything like that at all.
Because you mentioned Hostel that you'd seen earlier.
Yeah, that's no...
No, I that is very...
And Hostel.
That was just painful.
I've not seen those either for the same reason.
Don't. Saw is completely different. I've never watched Saw because my mum actually banned them from my house when we were younger.
And I think there's an element...
There is kind of an art to Saw which doesn't exist in Hostel.
Yeah, I think there's an element for me as well that I don't mind kind of realistic blood and gore and stuff like that. I can't stand injections and eyeballs and things like that. Yep. But I don't mind realistic blood and gore as long as it is in a kind of horror stroke fantastic setting. So something like the Evil Dead films, for example, loads of blood and gore, but it doesn't bother me. You know, something like Brain Dead, the early Peter Jackson, so much blood that you don't even know what to do with it. But it's in a kind of like a fantasy, fantastic setting.
Yeah.
But the films that take that, and my understanding is like Saw, Hostel, which really give you a, this could actually be happening.
Yeah.
This is actually real.
That's
I don't
horrible.
Like that. I find
like
that very hard to watch.
The good thing about it is, it's not people just being tortured. These people do have a choice what happens to them as well.
Well, you so could die.
And they deserve to be there.
Yeah, and they've done something to be there. They're not nice people at all.
Yeah.
They've done something. They've killed people.
It's
they've
retribution,
raped people.
Isn't it?
They've done something.
I'm with David in that I can't watch it. The closest I've got to it in recent years is Midsommar. I don't know if you've seen Midsommar.
We haven't seen
that. That was with Florence Pugh, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it's bad.
It's brutal. I mean, it's beautifully shot film.
Yeah.
And it's not gory in that sense, but horrible things happen to people.
Yeah.
Really horrible things.
Yes.
And
see, that lost me at about the 3/4 mark, that film.
Did it?
Yeah.
Did you watch it through to the end?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was in the cinema, and I thought to myself, this is great, this is great, this is great, that's surprising. Ew, this is great. Oh.
It does go a bit mad.
Oh, now it's the Wicker Man, is it?
It's the Wicker
Man.
Yeah.
A lot of that narrative was just unnecessary.
Yeah. But that's the closest I've got to a film where you see some kind of gratuitous violence like that.
Yeah. And I sometimes think to myself, you know, if I wanted to watch, you know, like an autopsy documentary, I could watch an autopsy documentary. I like my horror to be
fantastic
in some respect. I like it not to be so real that, you know, I like rubber monsters. I like the ludicrousness of it sometimes. You know, this concept that people could perhaps pull people's heads off with their spines dangling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's absolutely impossible.
So what I'm hearing you say is you like people to be wearing rubber suits?
Gimp masks.
Oh, no.
No. Like the Invisible Man.
And changing the subject now.
It's fascinating. I'm interested. So one final thing on the Saw films. So you watched all eight of them,
in
2 days.
In 2 days.
And how did you come out of that? Did you?
I was really sad.
Feel
I
that you wanted
them.
To wash your hands, or were you excited by it, or?
I can't really describe fully what they're like. They're so amazingly put together. Right. They're not just sitting there watching people get tortured, because it's really not. It's not even about that, really. It's about people learning from the mistakes and looking back at what they did and looking at other people and whether they want to help people. It's just honestly watch the first one. There's no gore really in the first one at all. It's just fantastic.
Mm. Okay, wow. We will. Thank you, Eloise. And
what's happening?
George, on a completely different note, I believe you've been watching something very interesting.
Yeah, and it's a programme that starts with blood, actually, which is called I'm Not Okay With This, which is a new Netflix series. And it's a short series, it's 7 episodes, and they're only about 20 minutes long each.
And is it complete in itself? Is it going to be another season?
I'm hoping there's going to be another season, but it's because it does end on a cliffhanger.
Oh, right.
But it also completes a story arc in a sense.
Okay, good.
It's a horror story, but it's also kind of a coming of age drama. It's about a young girl at high school whose father committed suicide, and she doesn't really know why. He didn't leave a note. Who's got all the usual kind of growing pains of adolescence. She's coming to terms with her sexuality, and as she gets angry about things, which happens quite a lot to her, she starts to realise things happen around her, and she's got these latent superpowers that she doesn't know how to control.
Oh, nice.
So she's trying to contain her anger and work out what it is and what's going on, and she's got a sense that she's being followed by someone. And then there's the kind of teen drama element of it with some of the characters, and it's the two leads really are two people who were in It Chapter One.
Yes, we recognise
that girl. That's right. I recognise her.
Sophia Liz.
She was young Bev, wasn't
that's
she?
Right,
that's
yeah.
right.
And I thought it was tremendous. I mean, it starts with her, just watching the trailer as we talk, it starts with her walking down the road towards us, covered in blood, a bit Carrie-like in a dress, and then flashes back to the events that have led up to that. And it's this kind of mysteries that start to unfurl, and she starts dig into what happened to her father and what her powers are.
Now, David and I have seen 2 episodes of this, and we're quite divided on what we feel. I quite like it, actually, and I want to know what happens.
I'm finding it a bit too much of a slow burn for me again. I think I like more to happen in the opening episode, so I kind of get to grips with what's going on.
See, whereas for me, I like the Shakespeare element of you do see the girl, and there is definitely, she is covered in blood, and you want to
know.
You're almost told the end, but you want to know how she got there, but you're not told the end in this case. But it gives you that feeling of, I want to pursue this, I want to find out.
I thought it was marvellous character drama, and I actually, the scripts for me are a masterclass in how to fit a story into 19 minutes, the first episode. And having watched the series over the 2 days with Fiona, we both loved it. Looking back now, I feel like I watched a whole series of 40-odd episodes.
So there is an economy in here.
For me, it's the same difference between novels and comic books, that economy of having to tell a story in 20 pages as opposed to, as long as you want.
Yes.
And that's what I kind of get a sense of here. And this is actually based on a graphic novel.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, although they've changed it quite dramatically.
Right. Yes.
Something
to look out for on Netflix. And we spotted it popped up, and
It was her that drew me into it, because I'd enjoyed her so much in It that I saw her face on Netflix and thought, I've got to see what this is.
Yes.
And as soon as I was watching,
The only character we had a problem with in It was the lad who's out of Stranger Things.
Yes, yeah.
Because we kept thinking he's had a
Stranger Things
all the way through watching it.
It was just quite
spoilt it a bit for us.
It was distracting to say the least, because he's so.
I thought it was. I loved it. I haven't seen chapter 2 actually, but I thought it was really interesting how self-referential the whole thing's got, because Stranger Things was so inspired by It, and then now they've made It inspired by Stranger Things, inspired by It. It's kind of it's eaten itself.
He basically plays the same character in both.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, and that's what we found so distracting about
it's confusing.
When we saw Stranger Things, we were looking at him thinking he's just like some, other young lad character of that
era in the 80s.
He's never going to be able to play anything else ever now.
So we wanted to mention one other thing, and we couldn't remember. Robin, was it you that was recommending Castle Rock?
Yes, it was. I'd seen the first season on DVD.
That's it. I thought you'd seen the second season.
You've seen the second season as well.
Because Sam and I have seen the second season now.
Oh,
and
have you?
And we started to watch it on the plane coming back and going to LA recently to the Gallifrey Convention. Absolutely compelling. So almost the second we got home, Sam signed up for whatever it was on.
It's Star Plays on Prime, Amazon Prime.
And we watched the rest of the second series. And... oh, my goodness me. We've seen the first season as well. And I have to say, I thought the first season was just okay.
Compared to the second,
a bit obscure and a bit obtuse as to what was going on. And
yeah, you had to be aware, really, of Stephen King's work to a certain depth in order to get all the records.
Season two of Castle Rock, which is a self-contained season, so it's a bit like American
Horror Story.
You can
just watch it without having seen the first.
You can just dip into an individual season. Season two... I've honestly, it's got to be one of the best things I've ever seen, least in the last two or 3 years. Absolutely compelling viewing.
Addictive.
It takes as its basis the idea of Annie Wilkes off of the book Misery, who was the person who was the writer, as a younger woman coming to Castle Rock with her daughter, trying to escape an abusive relationship, or at least that's what she tells her daughter. And it follows Annie, and you've got all this stuff going on. It transpires. She's got very severe schizophrenia. She's really not well. It brings in the Marston House, which, of course, is from
Salem's Lot,
which is in Jerusalem's Lot. Yep. There's a cult have taken over the Marston House, and they're, like, resurrecting dead people by putting them into coffins full of slime in the basement. No spoilers. Stop it. That happens in the first episode.
It's like a minefield of spoilers.
and the whole thing kind of starts to spin and progress from there, and it's absolutely compelling, wasn't it?
I think it's
amazing. You had me at Marston House, your sweet talker.
Honestly, you would get all the Stephen King references in this. And actually, the actress who plays Annie Wilkes. She's superb.
Good.
She really is.
But there's lots of characters from the other novels and the other stories and stuff coming in. Sheriff Pangborn and Ace and all sorts of people. And the places and the plots and everything. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. So anyway...
was a little bit of Crocodile Dundee theme music by Peter Best, written by Katie Melua and Guy Chambers.
Katie Melua, really?
Yes. Yeah,
apparently.
Of all people.
She wrote that.
Yeah,
yes.
Never knew that. So, which leads us nicely into what David is going to be talking about with our film of the month.
I was going to keep it as a surprise, but you've given it away now.
Oh,
yes.
Were you?
So, after all this death and horror and sore and good to start to watch, I thought let's have something slightly lighter as a film of the month, and let's go for Crocodile Dundee.
It's got big knives in it, though.
It's got a big knife. Call that a knife? Have we all seen Crocodile Dundee?
Yes.
I have not, no.
You haven't.
It's
Eleanor
a must watch.
Hasn't.
It is available on, was it Netflix?
Is it Prime?
What's it about? It's about an hour and a half long. sorry, it's my standard joke.
He beat me to it.
Yes. No, Crocodile Dundee is... It's kind of all based around the cult of an actor called Paul Hogan. Now, if you don't know who Paul Hogan is, Paul Hogan's an Australian actor who made his name in a TV series called Hogan's Heroes.
Okay.
And basically, he plays an archetypal, stereotypical, if you like, Australian with a hat with corks around it who kills and wrestles alligators.
Yeah.
And, g'day, mate, how's it hanging? Have a tinny. And all of that kind of stereotypical Australian stuff. That's Paul Hogan.
Okay.
That's his character. So the idea of Crocodile Dundee is that you take that character and you send a journalist to interview him about how he killed a crocodile in real life. She goes to see him in Australia, interviews him, They go off on a bit of a walkabout to show her the sights and stuff like that. She kind of falls in love with him and says, well, hey, why not come back to New York? So he comes back with her to New York. So now you've got this Australian guy who knows nothing about the modern world thrust into New York, trying to make sense of it all.
Yeah.
With magnificent scenes, like he's in a car and it stops at a junction, at a stoplight, and he leans out and says to a random guy, oh, hi, you know, I'm Crocodile Dundee. How you doing? You know, oh, yeah, well, yeah. I'll see you around. I'll probably see you. I'm in town for a few days. I'll see you later. You
know? Really innocent.
That naivety.
Really,
yes,
really
he
innocent,
is.
Naive. And the film,
out of water.
The film is beautiful.
But people react to it in an unexpected way.
Yes.
Instead of sort of going, oh, who's this, you know, strange person, they actually like him.
He like makes a difference.
Because he is very different from anybody
and
else.
It's a wonderful rom-com. Like it's
very funny.
It's such a lovely, funny film. I love Paul Hogan's character.
Yeah, I do.
He always makes me smile. He's one of those kind of actor characters that always makes me smile.
I'm really intrigued. I really want to watch this.
It's a fun film. Yeah. If you're looking for something fun and easy to watch.
1986.
I don't think I've seen it since the
80s. Really?
Plays Mick Dundee. Paul Hogan plays Mick Dundee. And the journalist lady is Linda Kozlowski. Who, subsequent to the film, Paul Hogan actually married her 15 years or something before they divorced. Because I thought this was interesting.
They did have children together.
One thing that I found fascinating reading on Wikipedia about the film, because when we watched it recently, we were both saying that you can absolutely tell that Paul Hogan and Kozlowski have got like this
chemistry.
The interaction, the chemistry is there. One of the big complaints about the film is that apparently they have no chemistry.
Oh, they definitely do.
What a load of rubbish.
They definitely do.
Oh, they are so weird.
Yes.
You can see it on her that she's completely and utterly.
She's completely besotted with him.
Absolutely. She looks at him like somebody who loves him.
What more proof
do
you need?
Exactly.
She was a very good actress.
I love the film. It's got so many wonderful moments. We mentioned the knife scene.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so much good. There's a couple of sequels to it, which is great. And I was so pleased literally this morning to discover that there's another film coming called The Very Excellent Mr. Dundee, which is actually all about Paul Hogan and what he's been doing since Crocodile Dundee.
Oh, really?
And they're,
but it's dramatised, I
they're
think.
They're mixing the character of Crocodile Dundee with Paul Hogan himself and putting him back into New York to try and figure out what the devil's going on. The trailer is wonderful. Just seek it out.
It does look fictionalised,
Mr. Dundee.
It must be about 80 now.
He's quite old. Yeah, he's getting on a bit.
He's still sweet though.
So Crocodile Dundee, absolutely love it. Well worth seeking out if you like a good old rom-com type film.
And that's all we've got time for now. Thanks so much to Patricia H. Ash, Eloise,
thank you.
Sheehan,
she's there.
David J. Howe,
hi.
George Mann,
thank you.
Eleanor Dean.
Thank
Robin Pierce.
Thank you kindly.
And our producer, Alex Levchuk.
You're still there.
Woo. You're still there?
Yeah.
And I'm
down
Sam.
That saw. Down that
and I'm Sam
saw.
Stone.
This
until
is
next
a
month.
Saw.
My mind.